Welcome to the Detroit Tigers Minor League Tracker Podcast. I'm your host, Keenan Carter, joined tonight by two special guests. It's been a goal of mine this year to kind of bring some fresh voices into the fold, some outside perspectives, perhaps, on where we're headed as an organization. So with that, I'd like to welcome Kevin Senna to the show. Kevin, how you doing?
Doing good. Thanks for having me, Keenan. Yeah. Really appreciate it. This is my podcast debut and glad to make it on your channel here.
Yeah, love to have some debuts. As a minor league aficionado, debuts are always good. But Kevin and I go back quite a few years, used to work together, and discovered that both of us were baseball gurus to an extent and played some Strat-O-Matic baseball for quite a few years. Now, whenever I bring Strat-O-Matic baseball up, I'm kind of surprised how many people have never heard of it. But it was a board game in the 60s and 70s where you kind of assign some realistic player tendencies on these cards. You roll some dice and you could kind of simulate actual baseball games. It's pretty much the nerdiest thing you can think of. And as we've got into the 21st century, that's evolved into software. So we do this all electronically now, which makes it even cooler. So Kevin and I have done that together for quite a few years. And it's kind of a niche community. They actually have an opening day for Strat-O-Matic baseball people to get together and talk about simulated baseball. I think of it as like a Magic the Gathering festival, right? Except I think with a Magic the Gathering festival, you at least have an opportunity to hook up at one of those things. For a bunch of Strat-O-Matic baseball guys, it's just middle-aged and older married dudes just nerding out over baseball. So,
I have to jump in there for a second because I really don't know how much hooking up occurs at a Magic the Gathering kickoff. I mean, I think that might be hooking up might be a little bit outside their focus at the moment there. But I'm a big fan of Strat-O-Matic. I actually started playing the game when I was like 8 years old. And my claim to fame right now is that I actually just got my nephew into it. He's a huge Cubs fan. They live right down the street from Wrigley and got him his first Strat-O-Matic board game here over Christmas. And so he's ready to nerd out as well. So it's another generation of stat heads.
Excellent. So yeah, I kind of, Kevin, likes to dig into organizational pipelines, kind of a hobby of his. And I thought it would be good to get an outsider's perspective on what he thinks about our organization, what questions you have about where we're headed. And my second guest needs no introduction whatsoever, not making his podcast debut. He's the self-proclaimed conductor of the Matt Manning bandwagon, bandwagon that needs to be a double or triple decker at this point because they're packed in like sardines and people are running alongside it trying to jump on. But Brandon was one of the first ones on there. So from Bless You Boys, editor and contributor, writer, Brandon Day, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Keenan, how's it going?
Fantastic.
Yeah, I never did, real quickly, I never did play Strat-O-Matic baseball, maybe once or twice. Our improvisation on that in the mid-80s, say 84, 85, was that we played Intellivision baseball and kept enormous amounts of cards and data based on the completely unidentifiable game characters who were in blocky form. So, we obsessed about it, but we had already felt the touch of technology creeping in on us.
Yeah, there you go. So, big news of the week, Tigers avoided arbitration with a handful of players, Matthew Boyd, Daniel Norris, Blaine Hardy, Shane Green, and Nick Castellanos. Avoided arbitration with two other players back in November, I think, and that's James McCann and Alex Wilson when we decided to non-tender them. But one player that we have not avoided arbitration with is Michael Fulmer, which is interesting because the previous five guys that we inked to 2019 deals all came in under projections from MLB trade rumors, and the Tigers and Fulmer are fighting over $600,000 here. Brandon, what are we thinking here, trying to save a few bucks on Fulmer?
I mean, it's kind of gross. I mean, the Tigers have a long history of not going to arbitration hearings. They haven't been to one since 2001. And I imagine, that this will eventually work itself out. So I don't really want to make too big of a fuss about it. Presumably they'll end up kind of just splitting the difference here. But it does kind of kind of play to the trend that's going on this year. And we're seeing a lot of, you know, a lot of people in going, or at least looking like they're going to head to arbitration hearings or agreeing to contracts that are, well, you know, pretty a good deal below what the estimates are coming in at. So it's kind of the way things are going. You know, I know the Phillies are kind of up against it with Aaron Nola, who I think they're over $2 million apart on those two, $600,000, especially when you consider that Michael Fulmer is not Aaron Nola, and has continued to kind of struggle with injuries and hasn't really found that gear he had in 2016. You know, it's not a big deal. It's just, you know, it's one of those things that if you're looking at the Tigers and being very frustrated with the current kind of spending patterns and the kind of talk coming out of the front office, this is the kind of thing that makes you roll your eyes a little bit, but probably will be resolved before we get to February, I would assume.
Okay. All right.
My take on that is it's a much ado about nothing. You're 600,000 apart. That's, you know, half a season of a major league regular. You're going to settle somewhere in the middle. And quite frankly, I mean, this is maybe a force for the trees kind of thing, but I see that as, you know, it's not going to be a big deal either way. Either he's going to get the extra 600K or he's not, and they're going to split in the middle. And I mean, really, to me, it's just kind of a move along, you know, not a big deal.
Yeah, it's not enough where I think there's going to be bad blood or something coming out of this long term. Situations like the Nola thing are a little bit more touchy in that regard. But yeah, this one shouldn't go that route.
Yeah, I agree. No winner, no loser, really. So as far as Nick goes, he was projected to get $11.3 million, and based on MLB trade rumors, I think, who's historically been very accurate in these predictions, and the Tigers inked him for just a hair under $10 million. So that kind of drives us into, you know, just our conversation we want to have about Nick in terms of, is he still an off-season trade candidate, or are we still seeing him as maybe a trade deadline? Who are the potential players? I know they're, you know, Dodgers, Rays, Indians, Twins, probably cross the Twins off now that they signed Nelson Cruz. And then over the National League, Rockies and Giants have been sort of linked, with the Braves getting most of the news coverage as it relates to Nick. So, but what do we think that this dollar figure, does this dollar figure tell us anything about, the Tigers' intentions with Nick, his potential, to being more attractive as a trade candidate to contenders? Kevin, I guess I'll start with you. You did a little analysis here. What do you think around the league people are thinking about Nick and his value?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I literally spent way too much time looking about this Nick situation altogether today. I probably spent a couple hours. What I like to usually try to do is say, you know, if I'm a front office, what needs do I have and how do I fill those needs? And when what we're looking at right now in the offseason is you've got an outfield market that's been completely frozen while everybody waits for Bryce Harper to sign. And, it, you know, just a few hours ago, it sounded like, at least as of this time, the time of this call, you know, the Phillies sound like they're in the lead for getting Bryce Harper. And once he signs, then you would imagine you're going to get, you know, Pollock and Marquez and the rest of the guys that start signing from the outfielders that are available out on the free agent market. If I'm a front office, I'm looking and saying, okay, do I shell up cash for a free agent outfielder? Do I have anyone internally that I can use to fill that hole? Or do I need to go the trade route? I think that if you're looking at Cassiano signing for 9.6, that actually bodes really well for the Tigers to try to trade him, because that's about 1.7 from where he was being projected to sign. I think that was through trade rumors, like you mentioned. So I think that bodes well for the Tigers if they're looking to move him. And that kind of brings up one of my questions is, you know, why do the Tigers feel a need that they have to move him? Is he a guy that they want to just say, you know what, you're one of our guys. We developed you. You've been here for, you know, through your entire arbitration year. So 6-7 years, does it make sense to keep him and just build around him? Or is there some other motivation for trying to move him? And I'm going to say that because when I look at what the trade market looks like for him, I don't see a huge market. I see a very, very narrow market for him. So before I jump into that, just kind of turn it over to you and Brandon and say, guys, is he a guy that you want to trade? Or is it better to look at him as a building block and try to sign him in the offseason to a medium length term, like 2-3 years or something like that?
Go for it, Brandon.
Well, I mean, I think the problem in the Tigers, you know, thinking about, you know, keeping Castellanos long term is the fact that, you know, they've got Miguel Cabrera, Kristen Stewart, who, you know, is looking like, you know, he's going to be their left fielder of the future, at least for the time being, a good enough hitting prospect who should be able to hold his own. I don't know if he'll be able to outweigh his defensive liabilities, but, you know, the Tigers have a couple guys like that already where they don't really want to see them in the field. This is a, you know, these are players that would be better off playing first base and DH. And, you know, so from that perspective, I can understand why the Tigers probably have already kind of moved on from Nick Castellanos. It was really hard to kind of get a beat on last offseason because there were, you know, there were some kind of murky comments from the front office that they had at least reached out to Nick's representatives about an extension. And it just didn't seem like there were even any, you know, substantive talks of any kind. So I think at that point, the Tigers pretty much, you know, got it in their mind that, you know, Nick isn't going to be a Tiger long term. Castellanos and his representatives responded with a bunch of, you know, I want to be a Tiger for life. I love it here. I love the fans kind of talk, which is fine. But that's, you know, no one takes that particularly seriously. So, you know, I just think they're kind of at a point where it's not a great fit for what they're building, unfortunately. I think most of us would like to keep Nick because you don't, you know, you look at the farm system, you don't see too many particularly compelling bats coming along even now. There's a couple, but, you know, they could really use that stick. But the problem is, you know, the Tigers are really trimming the budget. And I think even the $10 million-ish for Nick is probably more than they want to pay on a right fielder who isn't going to be around. And they seem to be shopping him pretty aggressively as a result. But as Kevin says, I mean, there just isn't that much of a market for him. I mean, we saw what happened with JD Martinez. Nick Castellanos is a, you know, a lesser defender and a lesser hitter both. Although, you know, he's young, there is still, you know, potential for Nick to break out a little bit more, I think, especially perhaps in a little bit more hitter friendly park. But there just isn't a lot of there isn't going to be a lot of demand for him, I don't imagine, even after, you know, Bryce Harper signs and the market starts to move. I really thought the Astros might be a good place for him, where you could stick him in front of the Crawford boxes for 81 games per year in a smaller ballpark and just let him mash in there, and he would probably do really well. There's a couple other places where he would probably fit well as well, but it's narrow, and it's really hard to imagine, you know, the Tigers, you know, pulling like a 50 future value type prospect, like a, you know, a back end of the top 100 type prospect for him. And if they're not going to get that, the other thing that has to be taken into the calculation is that Castellanos is a pretty good bet to get, you know, an offer that would allow the Tigers to extend the qualifying offer to him and collect a compensation pick, which, based on the way things are going with them, is probably, they look like they're going to be a revenue sharing team this year. It looks like they're probably going to have like the 34th, 35th pick overall, based on that, you know, by the pick they would collect. You know, there's some factors there. You know, Nick could get hurt. He could not get much of a contract. That's not impossible, even though he's young. You know, the market is really, really hard to predict. I was really good at this 2 or 3 years ago, and I feel like completely out of my reckoning now with the deals these guys are getting. So the situation is murky. I really don't think there's much chance left that Nick has a future in Detroit. It's just a question of whether or not you can get enough to make it worth giving up, you know, that chance at a pick, which, you know, the Tigers are knee deep in what we would call, you know, fringe average type prospects, 45 future value type guys. The Tigers are really deep. Maybe the deepest farm system in the game in terms of, like, you know, prospects that aren't real exciting but at least have enough potential to be called prospects. They don't really need any more guys like that. So unless you're trading someone, you know, for someone good, you know, you're kind of just crowding out the roster, especially in the upper minors right now. So I don't know. There's a lot of considerations there, and I don't really know which way it's going to go. But the way the Tigers are shedding payroll over the past 2 years, I just don't think they even want to pay Nick that $10 million. I think they'd like to move him. And we'll probably be aggressive and probably not get that much for them, and then we will all yell at them again.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to summarize that, Brian. I mean, I don't think the organization's made a conscious decision. We must deal Nick either before the season starts or by the trade deadline under any sort. I think it's, you've seen Avila goes out, he's being very aggressive in what he thinks he wants back in a package. We all think that's unrealistic. If we can get a 50 grade prospect, maybe we pull the trigger. If not, we make the qualifying offer and collect the compensation pick. Nick goes out on the free market. Yeah. We bid him farewell.
Yeah, what I think is tough is the notion that like the Tigers can hold their ground here and then maybe, you know, flip him at the trade deadline. You know, we saw that the Tigers got, you know, next to nothing really for JD Martinez, and you know the situation is going to be the same at the deadline this year for Nick, and you know a team that trades for him now can at least perhaps recoup that same pick, although it may, you know, it'd probably be a lower level pick. By picking him up now and having him all season, you know, that part of his value is completely blown out of the water once the season starts. And that makes it, to me, even far less likely that anyone's really going to give you anything other than, you know, just pitching you some, you know, random, you know, prospects and taking on the money. That's probably all that you could expect once the season starts.
Here's one of the interesting things about him, and I'm looking at his stats right now, just a little bit of a correction. I said he got 9.6. I think he got 9.9 in arbitration. When I look at him, his stats really seem like they were artificially inflated a bit more than previous years, just because of some luck that he was hitting into. And so if the game the Tigers are going to play is let's hold on to him and try to flip him during the season, you know, you got to be a little bit nervous that he's going to regress. You know, there's no guarantee that he's going to put up another 350 on base and hit almost 300. I mean, those numbers are definitely atypical from what he's put up in the past. So, you know, he might not even perform to the level where he would get that QO if he's going to be a guy that regresses back to a 310, 320 on base percentage. He might not have anything other than the home runs to inflate his value. And he certainly doesn't have value as a fielder, right? So I think when the Tigers are looking at what are they going to do with him, if I'm looking at where they're at, they might even be best served to say, you know what, let's find a team that has a pretty good Latin American representation and picked up a bunch of, you know, 16, 17-year-old lottery cards and say, you know what, instead of going for a 45 value guy, let's go for, you know, four guys that have 40 value and they're real young and they're a bunch of lottery tickets. They might even be best served going that route if that's what they're going to do and they're intent on trading them.
The counterpoint to the regression fear, I would say, is the fact that Nick had absolutely no one hitting around him all year. If you're a team coming in to face that lineup, there's one bat you needed to fear all season. It was Nick. And if you pitch around him every night, you're going to get... Go ahead, Jim.
Well, sorry, and the other thing about Nick is that, you know, he's one of those rare players, and you know, Christian Yelich looked a little bit like this, just beyond having, you know, much more athleticism and defensive ability. As hitters, you know, Nick is the kind of guy who hits a really high percentage of line drives, hits a lot of balls hard, but doesn't absolutely barrel that many balls. He's kind of a guy who can fall in this weird range where, you know, it wouldn't surprise me to see Nick hit 320 some season, but he doesn't draw walks and, you know, he doesn't hit for a ton of home run power. And both of those things, you know, leave him just a little bit harder to project. He's always going to be a guy who kind of can rise and fall, you know, in these sort of BABIP fueled spurts. You know, he's not exactly Corey Dickerson necessarily in that front either. You know, Nick is a better hitter than that. But he's not a guy that you can easily bank on, because a lot of his value is going to depend on, you know, are a lot of those hits falling. He's not going to, you know, draw 12%, you know, walks and hit 35 bombs for you. You know, he's young enough that maybe there are changes. Maybe going to a team that's a little better at coaching hitting, in my opinion, you know, might help him a little bit. But yeah, overall, he's not a guy that you can walk into a, you know, talks with another team and like guarantee, like, you know, this guy's gonna, you know, get on base at a 350 clip and, you know, slug 500 and be sure that that's gonna happen. There's a lot of good ways that another team is gonna be able to push back, you know, based on the batted ball data particularly, and argue that, you know, you're kind of selling us a little bit of pie in the sky there. So, you know, I think Nick is probably better than the numbers necessarily would indicate if you're looking to actually project him. But it's a hard argument to make. It's not an argument that you can conclusively make to another team.
Very good, very good. So, and I think the Nick conversation sort of leads into the overall organizational structure and philosophy of the Tigers, which, Kevin, I think in reading your notes that you sent over to me, it sounds like you spent some time researching and were unable to come to any conclusion whatsoever as to what our organizational philosophy is. And I think that's something that kind of frustrates a lot of us too, is as we kind of profile a lot of the draftees, you know, past several drafts, is, all right, what is our profile? What are we looking for? So I guess, you know, in your research and digging into our organization, what kind of questions did you have, and what kind of things did you notice up and down our organization?
Yeah, it's first of all, anything that you do when you're looking at the prospects, and you know, I know I'm really preaching to the choir here, is you really have no idea what you're going to get for sure from a prospect. I was looking at Kevin Plawecki, who is the catcher that the Indians picked up from the Mets, and coming up, he was a top 50 prospect, you know, on everybody, because he was expected to be a high average, really good defensive catcher. And then he comes up to the major and, you know, apparently he's not that good defensively. And apparently he doesn't hit the ball very well either, except when he's hitting home runs. So, I mean, it seems like his profile completely changed once he actually got to the majors. And so the reason I bring that up is to kind of say, you know, the prospect thing, projections, is a lot of, you know, art instead of science. And so you don't really know exactly what a player is going to be until they actually get to see major league pitching, right? Or major league hitting. And so some of that's going to be kind of, it's kind of murky to try to figure out what you got. What was very interesting when I looked at the Tigers was I see a lot of guys that want to hit somewhere between get a 210 to 230 on base, and seem to be profiling for 10 to 18, maybe 20 home runs. I don't see a ton of guys that seem to be especially good out like defensive fielders. Now the pitching's something different because I'm also on the Matt Manning bandwagon there. But from the hitting side, it's very confusing to see what this lineup is going to look like from a structure perspective. Nico, is it Goodrum, the second baseman that you got? I mean, he looked like he'd be pretty good, but he's 26, just seems to get his first taste last year. You know, does he have a lot more growth in him? And I'm going to butcher his name, but Heimer Candelario, the third baseman you picked up from the Cubs, he fits that exact same profile, right? 310 to 330 on base with a, you know, maybe he tops out at 20, 25 home runs. Are you going to have, is Kristen Stewart going to play every day? Is he your first baseman and move Miggy to DH full time? I mean, to me, Miggy's got the conditioning of Babe Ruth. You know, he's at that age where you probably want to have him at DH 140 games just to keep his bat in the lineup, which makes an opening there at first base. And then you've got three guys right off the bat that look like they're big home run guys with low on base. I mean, is that where the Tigers are going? Is Daz Cameron aside, the rest of your lineup is that guy?
Wow. A lot there. Brandon, I'll let you respond to that first of all, I think, before we get into sort of the major league building blocks, sort of the organizational philosophy about what type of hitters are we looking for and where are the impact players?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true that if you look at the Tigers farm system, you know, hitting is not the strong suit down there. You know, the Tigers have spent most of their high draft picks, you know, over the last 5 years, and really going back further than that on pitching, and that's reflected in, you know, any top 10 list you're going to see out there. And you know, it is pretty tough to project. I mean, my general philosophy when I look at, you know, anybody's farm system is to kind of put guys in buckets. Like if you've got, you know, four outfielders, none of whom can play, you know, center field, but all have some potential with the bat, you know, hopefully you get one of those guys. You know, I mean, you kind of have to think about it that way, like, you know, 50 future value prospects, guys who are in the back end of the, you know, the top 100. If you've got four guys like that, you know, hopefully you get, you know, a starting pitcher and a reliever. I mean, you really do have to kind of always keep in mind that, you know, whatever the best case scenario is, you should divide by at least half. And that, you know, this is all just kind of a vague way of going about it, but it's a, you know, it is more of an art than a science. So, you know, I mean, we've got basically when I look at the farm system, I've got Isaac Paredes, who probably will end up playing third base, who I think is the best hitting prospect in the system, and he may look good. Like, yeah, one of the better hitting prospects in the game, maybe, that by the end of this season, once you see Vlad Ito and guys like Bo Bichette graduate, Fernando Tatis, he may kind of get up into that upper tier of hitting prospect. But beyond that, you know, Daz Cameron is a nice, well-rounded player who I think will hit, but he's not going to be a, you know, an offensive force necessarily. You hope he can kind of give you like league average or maybe a little better production and play a little bit better than average center field. You know, those are, you know, probably maybe even not realistic expectations, but that's what you're hoping for. You know, if you're out there expecting Daz Cameron to, you know, be prime Andrew Jones or something like that, you know, that he just doesn't have that in him. So, you know, the potential for a star, like a star position player, really isn't there right now. You know, Paredes is an average defender probably at third base, and that bat gives you something. But, you know, you've got a lot of guys like Willie Castro, the shortstop prospect that we got from the Indians, Cody Clemens, who we drafted last year to play second base. You know, some of those guys are, you know, are prospects where if you have enough of them, probably someone will work out. But there isn't really any, you know, any above average future all-star type potential in that group, I don't think. You know, we'll give it another year and kind of see how that goes. But the Tigers rebuild fundamentally is built on pitching. And they, you know, they hope to kind of feed a few players in. You've got guys like Candelario and Stewart, who should be, you know, auxiliary pieces, really, if this is a good, you know, if there's a good team coming down the road 2 or 3 years from now. But there's a lot of work left to do, especially at the, you know, in the middle infield. I don't worry too much about first base. I don't worry a lot about corner outfield, because I do believe that when the time is right, the Tigers will spend on free agents, you know, not to the level that Mike Ilitch would have, but enough where those kind of positions can be filled, especially when you see, you know, free agent contracts declining in value and term. You know, the Tigers shouldn't have any trouble filling some of those spots. My key concerns are, you know, the Tigers need to be strong up the middle. They need two good middle infielders, and they've, you know, somewhere along the way, they're going to have to add another, you know, really big bat somehow, because you just can't, you know, you won't ever really be able to rely on Miguel Cabrera for that again. We might get lucky for a season or something, but yeah, I mean, those days are kind of over. So yeah, there's a lot of problems there, but I do try to focus on what I think are the key weaknesses in the system, and it's, you know, it's basically the middle infield. I feel like catcher we're probably going to be, you know, in pretty good shape at. I'm a pretty big Jake Rogers fan, even more than Keenan is, I think. And you know, Grayson Griner looks to me like a guy who probably can be a pretty good backup, at least, you know, until kind of, you know, wear and tear starts to take its toll. And at that point, he's probably just going to fall right off the map. So, I mean, that's kind of my overview of where they're at positionally. The Tigers have some younger guys, you know, who just kind of are emerging at rookie ball or did emerge this year, like Wenzel Perez, shortstop, switch hitter with really nice bat control. Looks like he should hit for average, but we don't know what kind of power he's going to have. And that's similar to Willie Castro, you know, like he can play the position, but he's probably going to be a below average stick, and he doesn't have the defensive, you know, freakish upside that someone like Jose Iglesias had. So, yeah, those are kind of the key problems. I think, you know, as far as pitching goes, it's not hard at all for me to see this coming together with a lot of homegrown, cost-controlled pitching in a couple years that would really provide, you know, a pretty cheap foundation to allow the team to go out and spend on what I regard as more free agent dollar-worthy assets, which is usually hitters. Those are just safer bets. I don't actually mind that the Tigers are building from a pitching perspective instead of from a positional core the way the Astros or the Cubs did, because, you know, the Astros kind of made this work, but you've already seen the Cubs have to shell out these huge contracts to try to keep floating their pitching because they haven't graduated anybody of value as a pitcher over this whole, you know, period of their rebuild into contention, winning a World Series and trying to keep it going. So, you know, that whole thing can work for me. I'm not upset, you know, that the Tigers have gone heavily pitching. But yeah, it does leave, you know, pretty obvious the glaring weaknesses, you know, in a couple positions out there that I just don't really see an answer for that I really believe in yet in the system.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, kind of to answer your question, Kevin, what's our organizational philosophy? It's by a lot of the names you're hearing from Brandon there, it's 2021, 2022, and cross our fingers on a lot of guys. Like that's where we are.
I've got, you know, I mean, right now it's Paredes, Rogers, and Cameron, and a ton of suspects. And even those three are obviously still suspects, but I feel pretty good about them.
How do you feel about those three guys in particular defensively? I'm a big Jake Rodgers fan as well. So you and I are aligned on that, I think, more so than Keenan. but how does Paredes look? Is he going to stay it? Is he going to go to third? Is he a shorts?
Yeah, he's going to have to.
What's he looking like?
He's going to have to go to third, I'm pretty sure. I mean, he's got really good hands. He's got a good arm. I like his hands. I think he could play shortstop in a Johnny Peralta-ish fashion, perhaps. Oof. But the range just isn't there. So, yeah, moving him to third base, I think, is probably a no-brainer. Like, maybe he'll play a little second for a little while before they kind of get it all to work. But, you know, Daz Cameron looks to me like probably an average major league center fielder. He's got a little work left to do, I think. But I think he can get at least to that level, maybe a little bit better than average. It's tough. Like, Comerica Park center field can really wreak havoc with how defenders are evaluated sometimes by defensive runs saved and such. So, yeah, you know, I'm not going to obsess about it one way or the other. I think he'll be fine in center field. He'll be at least an average player. And I think Keenan and I both would agree that, Jake Rodgers defensively should be one of the better defensive catchers, you know, entering the league over the next couple years. It's just a question of, you know, whether the bat is enough to keep him in the lineup. And, you know, we can argue about what level it has to get to do that with a defender who's that capable. I don't want to overstate this, but I think Baseball Prospectus, who does their, you know, their kind of analysis of minor leaguers, had Jake Rodgers at 4 or 5 wins defensively last year based on his framing, blocking, etc. On the defensive side, I think we're going to be all set at catcher too.
Yeah, he's downright nasty back there. There's no other way to describe it. All the reports on him. Oh yeah, all the reports on him are as advertised and then some as far as him behind the dish. And as for Paredes, there's just no way he sticks it short. I was watching him play in the Mexican Winter League a couple weeks ago. He's thick. Like, his chest sticks out like a bodybuilder. It just he clearly needs to. Yeah, third base is probably right. I mean, the reports of his defense are good, that he's smooth, he's got good hands, good instincts, strong arm. But I don't see it. Yeah, there's no way he sticks it short. I don't think anyone really believes that he'll stick it short at this point. One of the questions that you had in your notes, Kevin, about building blocks were Candelario and Goodrum. And first of all, I think Candelario is a building block. He's my favorite player. I love him. So I have a little bit of bias there. So I'd be curious to see what people outside the organization think of him. But as far as Goodrum, you know, I hadn't really thought of him as a building block. I don't know that too many people do. But I'd be curious to get both of your opinions as to whether Nico Goodrum is a potentially long-term building block for this organization.
I don't know. It all comes down to how you want to define building block. I think Nico Goodrum could be a useful utility man for a good while, but I kind of see Jamer Candelario as being more of like the Marwin Gonzalez type, who we could probably move around the infield anywhere but shortstop, make other things work, be an effective hitter who gets on base and has power, but isn't like a force. He's probably not going to be like a middle of the order hitter. So I kind of look at him, you know, as that guy, like someone who ideally he would be like the guy who's kind of flexing around everywhere and not someone that we have to like lock in at a position and say, you've got to hold it down all year. Even though, you know, his defense at third base has been fine. He's basically been an average defender. Nico Goodrum is a little harder to tell because I haven't really seen him play enough defense. Like the Tigers, you know, they didn't put him at second base and just let him run all year, which I kind of in retrospect wish they would have. They moved him around a little bit as well. He played a little shortstop. He played some first base. You know, he looked to me like a competent second baseman, but he continues to grade out less than that. If he could play that, you know, then to me, you've got two guys who, you know, who I kind of like, who are both switch hitters with power, the ability to, you know, draw at least an average amount of walks and can move around the field, you know, pretty well, you know, without too much issue. You know, Nico Goodrum could probably play corner outfield, no problem. Maybe Candelario could as well, but those are two guys who I think are nice pieces to have, but I don't really regard either one as like a real building block. So yeah, that's my take.
That kind of jives with what I was looking at and what I was seeing too. You guys picked up Jordy Mercer over the off season, and I think he's a good I think you described that hold the fort kind of guy. Nico Goodrum seems like he could be a guy who would fill that as well at second base. And so, you know, they're going to underwhelm, I guess, in some regards. And in some areas are going to be a little bit, you know, you're not going to be as grateful, you know, that for them putting out league competent production out there. Right. You mentioned a guy earlier in Cody Clemens, who I think if he's got even a fraction of his dad's drive and determination, you know, he could end up being a guy who looks really good for you out there at second base. But like you mentioned, he was just drafted. So, you know, you're probably 2020, 2021 before he's there on the field every day. And if you're running Nico Goodrum out there, and he had surprisingly decent production last year, 8.5 walk percent, 16 homers, 12 steals and 500 plate appearances. I mean, that's not a bad guy to have, especially on the cheap as you're, you know, if the front office is still shedding salary for the big run in a few more years, you know, he's a useful piece to have. Again, is he a building block? Eh, maybe not, but he can hold a fort, and you need a lot of guys like that while you're bringing up the rest of your pitching and while those guys like Mize and Manning and Burris and whoever else they all develop.
Five draft, he would get snatched up instantly. Like, he's the kind of player that a lot of teams would really like to add to their core to be a guy that gives a manager that kind of flexibility, but who still can steal bases and hit for power and get on base just to a decent degree as well. And the power potential we saw was pretty legit. I mean, he and Candelario both actually hit some real bombs to the full pole field, you know, 440-foot, you know, missiles. So, yeah, I mean, there's a little more potential there. And it's with Nico, it's just so tricky because I didn't really, you know, he wasn't on my radar as like a real prospect in the Twins organization. And then all of a sudden he looks like, you know, like a 1-2 war player, like pretty solidly. And he kind of came out of nowhere to me on that front. So I don't really have much of a sense of like his development track. If there's, you know, a chance that, you know, maybe something held him up for a couple years and he figured it out and, you know, is just undervalued. Some of those things are kind of hard to gauge if someone isn't, you know, making, you know, the prospect list in the top 20 consistently. Yep. And you're seeing a lot of different sites track him that way. So yeah, he's hard, but you know, he should have no trouble getting playing time this year, so we'll see.
Yeah, and Kevin, you kind of referred to him as, you know, we plug him in at second base. Got news for you. Tigers front office is in love with a kid named Dawell Lugo, who it appears is going to be plugged in at second base. At least I think he's going to be plugged in at second base. I don't know if Brandon agrees, but I would love for Nico to be the everyday second baseman this year. I think he's going to be more of a guy that we'll see in the lineup more times than not, but it'll be in a DH corner outfield, just spelling guys here and there, maybe a little first base. Just he'll play a little everywhere. I don't think he's going to be our everyday second baseman.
Yeah, I don't know about, you know, Dawell Lugo. I think, I don't know, I've heard from a couple people. I mean, I do know some people who are fairly close to the front office who do think the Tigers will eventually pick up a second base option, that they do at least realize that Lugo isn't ready yet. You know, I think Keenan and I would both say he'll never be ready. Yeah. I mean, there's just not much there. You know, there was some power that he displayed earlier in his minor league career, but as he's faced upper level pitching, I mean, he's just kind of a guy who can't catch the ball out front. Doesn't drive the ball in the air, has a really sort of rotational swing, like doesn't use his weight shift particularly well. You know, he's just kind of a flat swinging slap hitter who happens to be strong enough to hit the ball hard, and that's about it. You know, a little bit below average defense. There's not really anything there to hang your hat on. Doesn't, you know, poor pitch discipline. I mean, he has decent hands. He can put the bat on the ball, but, you know, we've said that about Jose Iglesias for years as well. And, you know, Dawell Lugo can't defend anywhere near that level. So yeah, there's not much there as far as I'm concerned. He could probably go bye-bye and I wouldn't say a word.
It's a bit of a problem. Seems like he's one of those guys who every once in a while you hear a guy who's a prospect early when he's really young, and then he just continues to live on that reputation, so he keeps getting opportunities, but the substance just kind of goes away real quick.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's like a poor man's Ronnie Rodriguez.
Yeah.
at least Ronnie throws some good leather out there and can hit for a little bit of pop from time to time. He still has that horrible plate discipline, free swinging approach, very similar to what Lugo has, but at least Ronnie can throw him out at shortstop.
You know, I mean, Dowell Lugo should go to the Astros where, you know, really good advanced hitting coaches help him to adjust his swing and his swing plane and try to unlock the raw power, because he does have pretty good, like 55 to 60 raw power, I would say, but he just cannot get to any of it against upper level pitching. And yeah, I mean, you know, what are you going to do? I don't have any problem with the Tigers hanging on to him and letting him play second base all this year and see if he can take a step forward. But the Tigers just are not a team that I have much confidence in developing hitters in general. So if a guy gets to the upper level and he doesn't have it, he just doesn't have it, I assume.
Well, I guess, all right, that's a great point, Brandon. So instead of shipping off these guys who, with some legitimate coaching, could become major league hitters, why don't we get some legitimate coaching to develop our players into major league hitters?
I'm all in favor of that. You know, I'll bring this up for Kevin just because this is, you know, this has been on my mind a lot the past couple weeks, where the Tigers have decided, and, you know, everyone from Al Avila to Lloyd McClendon, who's the hitting coach, to some of the minor league coaches have all emphasized that what the Tigers are really going to work on is trying to cut down strikeouts, and that they really want everyone to be, you know, desperately focused on their two strike approach. I actually heard something from Chili Davis with the Mets the other day, and it all elicited the same reactions on Twitter and from me, which is like, you know, first of all, the Tigers don't have a strikeout problem. The Tigers have a massive power problem that extends throughout the entire system all the way down to the A-ball levels. And that's a glaring problem. The Tigers also typically don't have too many guys, you know, who show much plate discipline. You know, you get to the upper levels and you don't see even like kind of those medium level Tigers prospects, you know, developing the ability to draw a walk, showing more, you know, better pitch selection. You just don't see it. And then you hear the Tigers talking, you know, the head hitting instructor in the entire organization talking about how two strike approach is going to be the key emphasis, and how he likes to flatten out everybody's swing. One of his favorite drills is where he lays up the four T's, you know, along the plate and asks you to sweep, you know, all the way across them. No competent, you know, hitting coach who is familiar with the principles that have come into play over the last 4 or 5 years and really relate all the way back to JD Martinez and then all the way back to Ted Williams would tell you to try to sweep, you know, a series of flat tees with no loft in your swing as some kind of method for improving contact. And, you know, the Tigers just seem, you know, pretty well out of touch on a lot of these things. You know, there's nothing wrong with trying not to strike out. I mean, if you look at the Astros and the Red Sox, their strikeout rates are lower than average, but you know, that's not the key factor. You know, the Yankees strike out a ton. They have power. You know, I can name a ton of organizations where strikeouts are not a concern in the mind of most of the coaching staff so much as hitting for power and not swinging at garbage. Like those seem to be the two focuses. So yeah, the Tigers, you know, I have some faith in them developing pitchers, but I don't know. I have real concerns the more I hear them talk about what their, you know, their philosophy and goals are going into this, you know, spring camp, that they just honestly don't know what they're doing at this point. There might be people all throughout the player development system that know. They've hired a lot of younger people. They've hired a lot of analysts. You know, they finally spent a bunch of money on technology. They've had the University of Michigan doing biometric research on hitters and pitchers for them. Those have all been positive signs because the Tigers were so far behind the analytics revolution and what you might even specifically call like the data revolution, like using actual technology in real time to train with. The Tigers, you know, have finally kind of started to make up ground there. But, you know, the people in charge of the organization are essentially the, you know, mid-2000s Minnesota Twins coaching staff. I mean, that's essentially what they've decided, you know, is they're going to base their organizational philosophy around, and that, you know, and those guys are terrifying to anyone who's watching, you know, really advanced teams, you know, win games, win World Series, develop prospects, you know, develop a consistently competitive organization like the Cardinals. The Tigers just do not seem to get it in a few areas as of yet.
So I got to tell you, I think I mentioned this offline before we all jumped on the recordings here, that I'm an Indians fan, and I got to tell you, as a fan of the Indians and the pitching rotation that the Indians have, I absolutely wholeheartedly love the direction that the hitters are going for the Tigers, because it makes me feel so much confidence in the Indians' ability to continue to be successful against the Tigers. So please keep it up.
Yeah, just keep an eye out for Alex Kirilov and the Twins over there. Other than that, you probably are fine for a little while.
Although Matt Manning made him look dumb down in the Florida State League.
Yeah, John Schreiber made Vladito look dumb in one at bat. That was cool.
Yeah,
I do have to say that your Tigers do have a lot of really good pitching prospects coming up. I really like a number of the guys that they've been able to add. I'm full on with you in the Matt Manning bandwagon. Obviously, Mize going 1-1. That guy looks like he's going to be great. Just need to monitor his innings. Manning is another guy that I think they need to be really careful about how many innings they're running him out. I think they made him jump like 60 or 70 innings last year. That usually ends up turning out in, you know, a trip to the surgeon. Bo Burrows is another guy who I think a lot of people have him like as a swingman, maybe long reliever. I like Burrows. I think he'll turn out to be somebody who can be really good, competent pitcher. I don't know about Fido. His injury and his kind of fall off in his last year there at Florida kind of made me a little bit nervous. There's another guy who I'm missing. Franklin Perez. He's a guy that I loved when he was with the Astros. And I'm also a bit of an Astros fan. So when I saw that they traded him as part of the Verlander deal, I knew that he was going to be one of the big gets for the Tigers. So seeing all those guys already, you know, coming up through the pipeline, in addition to you got Boyd, and if Fulmer can get, you know, can get his stuff working back the way it was a few years ago, I think you guys got a really good, enviable collection of starting pitchers. What is that, 8 or 9, you know, that look like they could be rotational pieces, which means, you know, when they injury out or whatever, you'll probably be still looking at a good, solid full rotation there.
Yeah, with a few relievers, hopefully. Yeah. There's a better caliber of even like the lower tier arms are a lot more projectable than they were, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. There's a bunch of guys, you know, who throw hard and actually have a breaking ball as opposed to the usual just throws hard. And all those guys need major command improvements, but there are enough of them where, it feels like the Tigers will probably pull another reliever or two, hopefully good ones to go with Joe Jimenez as well.
Yeah, and I'm glad you segued into that, Kevin, because you had kind of talked about Boyd and Fulmer and where they fit in the next 2 to 3 years. Matthew Boyd's an interesting, really interesting case because it's the best year of his career. His numbers aren't sparkling, but he was pretty good this year, and tons of team control left on that contract. I was kind of thinking maybe we would shop him this offseason because I'm not certain if he'll ever have a year like he had this past year, but I'm not sure because there's some really nice things when you watch him pitch. He doesn't have dynamite stuff, but he's got good separation between his fastball and his off-speed stuff. He located really well for the most part. So I don't know, Brandon.
He's got a little deception, you know, and he's kind of a Bulldogs type guy, and he's actually also been, and this might be the key thing, is that he's been, you know, pretty darn durable. He has never had a major injury of any sort since joining the Tigers organization in 2015. I don't think he'd really had anything too problematic before. And he's also a driveline guy, who's been training up there for the past few years and really took a huge, huge step forward with his slider this year. I'd have to look real quick to see what the pitch value was, but it was just a massive increase with that slider. He got a lot more depth on it, started kind of like dropping down a little bit more from his three-quarter slot with it at times, and was really like nicely kind of shaping it two different ways and using it really effectively. The pitch value this year is like 17.7. On the pitch value scale at Fangraphs. So, but the fastball, the other thing that got him was that the fastball lost a ton of velocity. Like he was really, really down in his velocity from sitting usually around 93 to being 89 to 90 to start the year. And it started to come back, but it wasn't until late in the season that we really kind of saw him sitting 92 to 94 the way you'd expect. And if he puts that together with the new slider, he's 27. I think there's a good chance he could take a little step forward, but I also agree that he's a guy that I expected to shop because he's 27. He's not going to get, you know, too much better than this. He could end up getting injured this year and not be worth something. So I would have, my thinking was that I would like to see them try to package, you know, Boyd or Shane Green with Nick Castellanos and try to, you know, even if you're not absolutely maxing out the value of that, if you could get one really good prospect out of it, that's more, you know, the way I'm thinking about it at this point. And that's something I would have advocated for the Tigers doing. You know, I still like Fulmer, but, you know, there's a lot of question marks there. And I still love Daniel Norris, but, you know, we just don't really know what's going to happen there. And if he struggles this year, if he gets injured again, he's going to the bullpen. So
that's kind of interesting to hear you say that, because when I look at how do you construct rosters and how do you construct teams and everything, I think there's a lot to be said for having a lot of those veteran presence guys that are going to stick around for a number of years. And so, you know, obviously you're not going to move Cabrera. He's got that contract for 5 more years, and he's not going anywhere with the 10-5 rights. And then, you know, you got Zimmerman, who's only got, I think, 2 more years left on his contract. So when you look at who are the guys that are going to stick around, I kind of figured you would take a guy like Shane Green or Boyd or both and keep them and say, you know what, you're not a world burner, but at the same time, you can be the guy that's the steady voice in the locker room and kind of show these guys what it's like to be a pro. And, you know, we're going to reward you for, you know, what you've given the organization and kind of keep you here for a while, so you can kind of provide some of that knowledge instead of cobbling together every free agent or trade guy that you can grab. So yeah, I understand the maximizing of the value, but what do you think about that kind of aspect of there's value in the leadership in the locker room of keeping a guy instead of just trying to max him out for a couple of 45, 50 grade guys?
I think there's some of that with Nick also. I mean, he's a leader in the clubhouse. And there's value in that. Brandon, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree as well. I mean, I would like to keep Matt Boyd. It's just, you know, putting myself into the headspace I've been in the past 2 years where I'm trying to figure out what the heck the Tigers think they're doing. You know, I mean, in Shane Green's case, I think, you know, he's sort of a different case. Like, I really like Shane Green. He, you know, he's a warrior out there, and he does have 2 more years of control. But he's also 31 and has had a lot of injury history. You know, for both our sakes, I would love to turn Shane Green into something and let him go pitch for a good team for what probably is the last couple good years of his career. That would be perfectly fine. Matt Boyd, I would like to keep him. It's just a question of, you know, are the Tigers going to keep, you know, Boyd, Fulmer, and Norris, or are they still thinking to themselves, and this has seemed to be their mindset, that they need to somehow turn those guys into, you know, a really good hitting prospect, like a really good, you know, star prospect. And I just don't know if anybody's even going to give up anybody like that anymore. Like, you know, I mean, if you have Fernando Tatis, like, no team is ever going to trade a guy like that again, it seems like. You know, things could change in the future, and I could point to, you know, mistakes made, like Brian Cashman, you know, not wanting to trade Gleyber Torres for Justin Verlander, and basically losing a World Series as a result, in my opinion. You know, you can screw those things up, but, you know, and so it just comes down to, can I ever get that from, you know, can I ever get enough from Matt Boyd to make it worthwhile? Because I'm also perfectly fine with keeping him. I'm just kind of, you know, the way the Tigers have talked, I kind of feel like they expect to move one of those three pitchers, Fulmer, Boyd, and Norris. And Boyd is the one who's probably closest to their ceiling at this point and is the oldest by a couple years.
You got to remember, too, though, as long as Dave Dombrowski is in the front office, you got someone who's willing to trade high-end prospects.
Yeah, but he doesn't have any. He's totally, totally out of them. The Red Sox system sucks now. But no, I know what you mean. There'll be a few people. Theo Epstein's not afraid to trade prospects, you know.
Yeah. I mean, from where I am, if I'm in the Tigers organization, I like that Boyd is a guy who goes out there and gives you a bunch of innings. I think he can slot in as a 4 or 5. He can give you that presence in the locker room, and I think he's a guy who you could sign for a couple extra years. And 27's not old, especially for a pitcher. He's still probably got some projection left. That's usually when pitchers start hitting the top of their aging curve, right? So he's probably got a number of years left. And especially, you know, you can keep moving him back further and back in the rotation as you graduate guys like Mize and Manning, et cetera.
Yeah. And he throws with the appropriate arm.
I'll be perfectly happy if we get to keep Boyd. That would work out just fine for me too. I would agree. Yep.
All right. Hey, look, we covered a lot of ground there. Let's see if we can hammer through a few listener questions. Got a few interesting ones that I've isolated here. Terry Nummer, who does a lot of my photography, we've featured on some articles lately, asks, how certain is the projection that Casey Miles will start the season in Lakeland? That's an interesting question because I think it's, I think we all expect Myers to spend the majority of the year in Erie. But I think the projection that he'll start the season in Lakeland is probably with 90% certainty. I don't know. I think it'll be very similar to what they did with Fieto last year. Keep him down in Lakeland where they can keep an eye on him. And let's be honest, the Eastern League is a miserable place to play in April. So I think they're very reluctant to send their top arms up there until the weather warms up a little bit. I don't know. Would you agree with that, Brandon?
Yeah, I mean, I would expect. I mean, they may be more aggressive than they were with Fieto, because you know Alex Fieto, you know, even before the velocity loss, I wasn't the biggest fan of, and you know there's a lot of question marks about him now. Mize, I think they would be more aggressive with, but it just makes sense to kind of basically have him in instructs. You know, is essentially what that's going to be. It's going to be like extended spring training, or maybe he pitches a few games for the Flying Tigers and then gets to Erie. Yeah, hopefully like mid-May, you know, late May, something like that. So, yeah, I think it's a pretty good bet. He starts out in Lakeland, but, yeah, you'd expect to see him at Erie. And I hope they'll be aggressive and move him to Toledo if he gets to Erie and is just mowing through people. I'm not a big believer in making guys like sit there, you know, and do it for a solid season at each level or anything like that. So I would kind of be aggressive with Casey Mize because I think he could already, you know, basically go into AAA and dominate. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. But yeah, starting out at Lakeland makes sense just more for player development reasons, not necessarily where his talent level is.
Sure.
So he had that flexor strain. Do you see them really being that aggressive on him and risking a potential Tommy John? Just because, I mean, a guy that high, you don't want to screw that up. Right, well, that flexor strain was seeing those forearm strains. That gets me pretty nervous.
Yeah, but that was, you know, that was 2 years ago. You know, he didn't have any problems last year that I'm aware of. So, you know, we'll see. I don't worry that much about those sorts of things. The Tigers are generally pretty careful. Like Kyle Funkhauser 2 years ago, you know, basically just had some elbow soreness, and they, you know, they took a look and there was nothing really wrong other than, you know, some minor inflammation, and they shut him down the whole year. So, you know, I would expect them to do the same thing if Casey Mize has any, you know, any sign of a real forearm problem. But I don't worry that much about like the innings so much as like the, you know, the game situation, like how much you're making him pitch in each game. So, you know, you kind of mentioned that with Manning a little bit earlier that, you know, he went from like 58 innings to 106 or 7, I think, this year. But, you know, you don't know what kind of work guys are doing, in, you know, outside of actual games, too. Some of that can kind of play into it. And Casey Mize seems like a pretty horsey type guy. You know, he's kind of built like a brick shit house and, you know, fairly, you know, well-conditioned, strong-looking athlete. So I don't know. We'll just kind of have to see. But those aren't concerns I really worry too much about, honestly. Like, you know, I just kind of play that kind of thing by ear. As long as the guy's feeling good, I'm pitching him.
Yeah, they were crazy cautious with Franklin Perez when they shut him down for the rest of the season. They kind of said, we don't really need to shut him down we don't believe we need to shut him down for the rest of the season, but we're going to anyway. And with respect to Mize, I think the fact that they started him at all in any professional games last summer or indicates that they're not going to be super cautious with him, because he had a pretty heavy workload at Auburn. A lot of late innings, high pitch counts, high stressful pitches, and we kind of thought maybe they were just going to shut him down for the rest of the season, but they gave him a few starts, and so I think that indicates, hey, we're not going to that injury you're talking about, Kevin, is behind him, and
yeah,
it's not a concern for the organization right now.
Well, and they also saw what happened. You know, they shut Fieto down. I mean, obviously Fieto pitched into the College World Series, had a really long season, but you know, he basically was on the shelf for 8 months and came out, you know, looking soft and, you know, with 4 or 5 miles per hour gone off of his fastball. So I don't know, that may have put them off their feet a little bit, you know, about letting guys sit for too long. I don't know.
Lesson learned. Yep. Okay. So Kevin, I'll kick this one to you. This is from Mark Delisle. 5 years from now, will the Tigers look back and say it was a mistake taking Mize at 1-1 over Joey Bart?
That is an excellent question. I really like both players. I'm gonna say yes, only because I go back to the injury risk that is not always shared by everybody. I just looked at Joey Barton. I thought his performance in college was great. I thought that he looks like he's the second coming of Buster Posey, which is very lofty praise, which means that he's going to come nowhere near that. so I think he'll probably still come in. I think Bart's going to end up being at least above league average type of catcher. And, you know, if he ends up running into an injury issue, you move that guy over to first base and he's still extremely productive. I would say it this way. I don't think either one would have been a mistake to take out 1-1. And I don't think you can fault anybody for wanting one over the other. It's just more of a question of what is your organizational philosophy. And if you've got the guys that you think can take those pitchers and make them productive major leaguers faster than you can the hitters, then you probably made the right pick in taking Casey Mize. So to answer his question, will they look back and regret it? Probably not. It's just always going to be that case of, you know, I had that one really hot girlfriend for a while and she turned out really hot again, you know, but at the same time, you married a beautiful woman and so it all ended up okay.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah, I mean, I like Joey Bart quite a bit too, and I could see where maybe, like, it's not a bad argument that Joey Bart will, over the course of their careers, be more valuable. But yeah, it's never going to be like a, you know, Matt Bush over Justin Verlander kind of situation or anything like that, so... Yeah.
Nobody would do that. Nobody would ever make that mistake.
You know, I wonder, you know, this is interesting maybe because, you know, because I'm a, you know, I follow the Tigers, you know, mostly, but I do pay attention to a lot of the other teams pretty well in depth. But, you know, the Tigers have a pretty good history of producing very durable pitchers. I mean, you know, Rick Porcello, Max Scherzer, you know, all these guys on top of Verlander, obviously, who's the most durable I've ever seen, you know, barring Nolan Ryan's late period career. I don't know. You know, I don't know if the Tigers really do something right or if they, you know, are particularly good about that. But, you know, it's been a long time since we've really had anybody, you know, have like a serious arm, you know, issue that kept them out of action. I'm trying to think, like, for more than like a couple months. You know, Verlander missed like, you know, 10 weeks once in his career. And other than that, I don't think ever missed a start. You know, Max Scherzer, just an absolute machine. Anibal Sanchez, at least for a couple years, was kind of the same way. So I don't know, maybe I look at the risk of injury a little differently. I kind of tend to be freaked out by shoulder injuries and not worry too much about Tommy John surgery. You know, obviously you worry about it. It's not like no big deal, but it feels like we're getting to the point where there's a lot better chance that if you handle it the right way and give the guy the right amount of time to rehab and recover, that your odds are pretty good that they'll get right back to where they were. So I don't know, that may be playing into, you know, some of my thinking on that as far as the pitching goes.
I'm probably going to make both of you have wake up in cold sweat by mentioning this, but I think the last guy that the Tigers had that had significant injury issues was Jeremy Bonderman.
Yeah, that's who I keep thinking of, too. I mean, Bruce Rondon blew out his elbow, but, you know, relievers who throw 100 with, you know, semi-shitty mechanics, like, well, you know, that kind of thing just happens. So, yeah.
Yeah, it was the video game's fault.
Oh, yeah, Zamaya. Oh, see, that's the one that really hurts, but oh, well.
Yeah, and my answer to the Mize Bart question, I think it all depends on Jake Rogers. I mean, if Jake Rogers pans out and becomes a Gold Glove caliber catcher with that you can plug into the 7-hole every night, then I don't think we regret anything with respect to Joey Bart.
Besides, we're going to sabotage, you know, Adley Rutschman's, you know, stock this year to move him down to like 7th or 8th, and then we'll just pick him up. I can dream.
Yeah, I'm on board with that.
All right, we're going to have to work together on this.
All right, so the next question, this one for me from Rick Morris, says, first thing you're looking forward to doing when you get down to spring training. So, yeah, I'm headed down to Lakeland, my first time, February 28th. So, man, I have no idea. I have no idea what to expect. I mean, I'm a fan first and foremost. I kind of considering it a bit of a business trip, and I hope to you know, get some interviews and do some work while I'm down there. But mostly I just want to kind of take it all in, having never been to spring training. I don't know. Have either of you guys been to spring training anywhere? What should I be looking forward to?
My parents go down to, where are they, Fort Myers every year for a couple months in this, you know, late winter, early spring. And so I am thinking I might try to do the same thing sometime in early March and get down there. But I've never been there before either, so I don't really know. My advice would be to talk to Miss Emily Walden of The Athletic, because I know she's going to go to Arizona and be doing Cactus League stuff this year instead of the Grapefruit League. So maybe she would be willing to, you know, give you some tips as, on how to get around, as long as you're willing to feed back some scouting reports to her.
Yeah, absolutely. How about you, Kevin? You make it down there?
I have absolutely no experience. All I can say is, as a Central Ohioan, going down to Florida in February sounds like absolutely fantastic.
Yep, same here.
Well, yeah. My wife's coming with me. The kids are staying up here with the in-laws, so it's a little mini vacation for sure.
Beautiful.
That's wonderful.
Let's see. So I think we're running a little long here. How about we got two more here. So, and Kevin, I'll throw this one to you. It's from Victor Hugo. He says, the Tigers seem to focus on pitching in drafts. In your opinion, is that the correct strategy? And it's an interesting question, because Al Avila has basically just been doubling down on his pitching philosophy, and that's, you can never have too many pitchers. He's just going to continue to stockpile them. Even though we just got done talking about all the deficiencies in terms of no impact bats throughout the entire organization. So what's your standpoint on that question?
Yeah, I'm kind of with Avila on this. I don't think you can ever have too much pitching. Just too much adjustment to major league hitters, guys that just don't develop those other pitches. And quite frankly, it's a lot easier to get guys that are hitters out on the free agent market that are impact players, I think, than it is to get the free agent pitchers that are impact guys, right? And you see that quite frequently. The only guys that tend to get major contracts or that get locked up, they're pitchers, you know, your 6-7 year guys. Now, yeah, you get the anomalies. You know, you're going to get Harper and Machado get, you know, they're looking at 6 to 10 year deals. But for the most part, you can get impact bats a lot easier than you can get impact pitchers. So if you want to develop and therefore draft a lot more pitchers than hitters, go for it. I think it's a sound strategy. You just got to make sure you get in the innings.
Saw Al Avila say this before the draft last year, and I cannot find the article, and I've really wanted to refer to it because he went on at some length. But basically what he was saying is that they, you know, they just feel that it's a lot, the pitchers have a lot more measurable attributes that you can look at in isolation of everything else and project them, whereas with hitters, it's all, you know, that's a reactive part of the game. There's always way more factors that can kind of play into it, and that as a result they feel like, you know, that they can put a greater level of confidence on their pitcher evaluations than they can on their hitter ones. And I agree with that. You know, I guess the only thing I would say, I don't have any problem with the Tigers, you know, going heavily toward pitching. If the best player in the draft that the Tigers can get this year is another starting pitcher, you know, I won't be the one screaming about it. I know a lot of people will. I won't be particularly upset about that. But I do think, to kind of go back to a point Kevin made earlier about kind of that organizational continuity and leadership, that at some point the Tigers do need to at least have enough of a young nucleus of position players to kind of, you know, hopefully kind of be the leaders and be the guys who, you know, that whatever veterans that we kind of have to feed in, you know, at first base or the corner outfield spots, that those kind of positions, that, you know, that they can kind of come into a unit that's already like well formed and plays hard and, you know, works well together. There is some importance to that too. I mean, my hope, and I'm sure this is probably the hope of every Tigers fan, is that there is a really kick-ass advanced college bat available in June in the draft to them, because they really need that. They really need like two or three guys like that, and I don't even care what position. Guys that look like they have the potential to be really impact hitters. So hopefully we can piece together another guy or two like that into the system. But overall, having an organizational philosophy built around developing pitchers makes pretty good sense to me, actually. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Good. We'll close with one last question, something near and dear to those of us who are subjected to watching this organization night in and night out for 162 games. The question comes from Michael H. Long. Any news on the FSD Tigers broadcast team?
Nope. Nothing yet. All I've ever heard is that they are, for the play-by-play guy, they really actively are conducting a national search and really want to go with someone new, which tends to make me think that Matt Shepard probably isn't going to get the gig, but I don't really know. But beyond that, we're going to have Jack Morris and Kirk Gibson in the booth again as color guys, the two most exciting and exuberant voices in baseball. So, you know, we have that to look forward to. Although I do love Gibby's sense of humor and analysis. Jack Morris, I could kind of do without. But
yeah, I'm good with Gibby. I'm good with Gibby. And generally, I listen to Dan and Jim a lot more than I watch the TV broadcast anyhow. So as long as that's intact, I'll have something to entertain me. All right. Hey, covered a ton of ground tonight, guys. Appreciate you both coming on. Let's see. I'm going to have a couple new guys who came out with some prospect lists. Fellows over at Baseball Farm came out with their Tigers list. And then Dave Eddy over at Prospects 1500 came out with a prospects list. So I've decided to have those guys on each on separate episodes so I can lambaste them about their rankings and tell them why they're wrong. But no, we'll have some fun with that. And spring training's right around the corner, which means college baseball's right around the corner and fantasy baseball's right around the corner. So I'll be back with my regular co-host, Eric Hostetter, talk some college baseball and fantasy baseball here in the coming weeks. Aside from that, guys, really appreciate you coming on tonight, and I'll talk to you real soon.
All right. Thanks for having me on. Good to meet you, Kevin.
Nice to meet you, too.
One of these days, and it won't be long. It won't be long now. One of these days, and it won't be long. You better come up. One of these days, and it won't be long. Keep your